pipe. "Breathe!" she shouted, not knowing if he was still alive. "What the frick are you doing?" At that moment, the Chimera's heavy flamer roared to life. A stream of burning promethium singed her face as it passed overhead. The ganger's command tent went up with a whoosh. There were figures within the inferno, thrashing out their last. The cannon opened up once more. It hit the Chimera with the ringing of 1,000 discordant bells. "Someone's got to get him," she hissed, and realised that someone had to be her. She crawled forward and got a glimpse through the dust. The two gangers were advancing as they fired. She aimed, but the moment had gone already. She cursed silently and waited as another salvo sprayed over her head. "Half-track approaching," Victor shouted. "More hostiles." She looked east. A vehicle was speeding up from the south, its red flag stiff in the wind of its own passing. "I'm going to take out this frecker. As soon as I do, everyone back inside. Breathe! Cover us!" There was another furious salvo. At this rate, they would have to change ammo belts. There was a brief pause and Minka changed position, crawling along the side of the burning tent. A body fell in front of her. A ganger, his skin burned away, showing a rictus of weeping muscle and teeth. She flinched, and then suddenly the two gangers toting the cannon were in front of her. They were trying to get around the flank as well. The lead ganger swung the ponderous weapon round. Wisps of smoke were curling from the barrels. There was no time to aim. She fired as she rolled into the burning tent, and then the ground about her exploded. The ganger truck arrived, travelling at high speed. It had an autocannon jury-rigged onto the back. It started firing wildly towards Victor and the others.
"Let's get the hell out of here,"
Breve shouted. The Cadians scrambled back towards the Chimera. Jaramir appeared confused. He was looking at his gun, as if trying to work out how to fire the thing. Victor pushed him forward.
"Get him inside," he told Jason.
The two black dragons ducked through the hatch. Jason covered Victor as he dragged Thaddeus back into their transport. The 966th Rifles Trooper had been burned along his right side. Silas had taken a hard round to the forearm.
"Where's Lesk?"
Victor demanded. No one knew. Victor looked out. The air was thick with smoke and gunfire.
"Minka!"
he shouted. Breve was already closing the back ramp as he slammed the Chimera into reverse.
"Where's Lesk?"
Victor shouted up at him. Breve didn't hear. He was shouting to the forward gunner to take out the gun truck. The heavy bolter spat fist-sized bolts towards the enemy. As their internal propellants ignited, the heavy caliber shells roared forward, black trails of smoke weaving one over the other. The salvo lasted only moments. But as the smoke cleared, the wreckage of the gun truck came into view.
"Lesk!"
Breve shouted. The Chimera rattled as hard rounds slammed on its outside. More gun trucks were speeding from north and south.
"It's like a frickin' convention," he cursed.
"Listen, we'll have to get out of here."
"Just wait, damn it."
Victor ducked out and kept low. As he ran towards the barricades, a figure caught his leg. A ganger playing dead. Victor fell and twisted and kicked out with his other foot, but the other man had him fast and he cursed. A shadow fell over him and there was the unmistakable silhouette of a spiky gang hairstyle. He was done for and scrabbled for his knife, but somehow it had come loose in the struggle.
"Move aside, Victor!"
He blinked up in surprise as a lasbolt flared for a moment, and the ganger holding his feet let go. It was Minka. There was ash and dirt and splatters of blood on her face and scorch marks on her jacket, but it was her all right. She had the gang leader thrown over her shoulder.
"Come on, Victor, get up and help me with this grunt."
"Yes, Lesk," he said,
then corrected himself.
"I mean, Sergeant."
They dragged the unconscious man up the ramp. He fell heavily against the reinforced plasteel floor as it closed behind them. The heavy bolter roared, hard rounds rattled against the Chimera's flanks, but Minka heard nothing. She wanted to salvage something from this fiasco. She tore the ganger's top open, yanked her medipack off her belt and stuffed the wounds full of gauze. "Stop him bleeding out," she ordered Victor. "Then tie his hands." She stood up. "Right. Who the freck fired without my permission?" she demanded. No one answered, but all of them knew. Minka turned to Arctur. She was trembling with fury and adrenaline as she grabbed him by his collar and dragged him forward. "Do that again, and I will execute you myself. Understand?"
Chapter 10 Karkul pushed through the crowds along the avenues of white tents. His first hours had been an extreme of elation, as his release and escape sank in, followed by the chill depths of fear as he learnt from wayside preachers and the rumour mill that contact with Orbital City had been lost a week earlier. Although no official announcement had been made, the view on the street was that the warp route way station had fallen to the Scourged.
"That's impossible," Karkul told them. "I was there a month before. The Navy was there. I saw them. They had two cruisers."
But no one listened to him. "Nothing has stopped them so far. Why do you think that will change? No one cares about us."
"The Emperor sees, and he knows and he cares," Karkul declared.
But then he fell silent as the implication of his words struck him. If the Emperor was all-seeing, then he knew about the murders Karkul had committed. He had seen the depths Karkul had sunk to. His immediate instinct was to try to flee once more, but what was there to flee to? How could he get back onto a transport? It was impossible.
"How long until they get here, then?" he asked.
The man shrugged. "Who knows? They could be here in days or a week." The prospect was chilling, and he turned away, back to the crowded streets of the tent city, which no longer appeared comforting. It looked bleak and desperate. Karkul felt trapped, duped, deserted. Wherever he fled, Dracul-Zar, the heretic warlord, followed. There was a doomsday atmosphere within the camp. Everywhere Karkul looked, he saw fear, hunger, despair. Preachers sermonised against 100 kinds of heresy. There were crude icons that were the object of adoration of chanting crowds, processions of penitents with needle-filled balls stabbing their chests till the blood ran freely, trails of naked repentants, arms lashed to stakes holding their arms out to either side, simple black hoods tied over their heads, and behind, a gaggle of shaven-headed women handing out cheap printed cloth badges. And at each intersection, gangers stood watching from the back of their gun trucks and half-tracks. The rumours were of religious images that spoke prophecies or that sweated blood. Anxious, ecstatic crowds gathered in anticipation of religious manifestations, praying in expectation of the end of their world. There were rings of feverish women dancing ritual steps to drive sickness away, rumours of sacred icons weeping or speaking to the true. There was a feeling of nervous exhaustion. And through it all, Karkul wandered. He knew no one, understood nothing. He was shoved, cursed at, threatened and tempted. And he was fearful as he watched three gangers drag a young man out into the middle of the crossroads. He was Karkul's age, someone like him. Karkul watched in horror as the gangers tripped the boy up, let him crawl a small distance before stepping on his leg.
"This sump scum is a thief," the chief ganger called out, patting his club into his open palm.
He put his foot into the small of the boy's back.
"I declare thee guilty, sump scum, and here is the punishment of the God Emperor of mankind."
The club rose and fell, and then it was done. Karkul's mouth went dry. He had killed, just like that, but not in daylight and before a crowd.
"So die, all thieves!" the ganger shouted,
and somehow Karkul felt the ganger's eyes on him, and he turned and hurried away. There were sanitary posts between each gang's territory. Medicaid volunteers stopped everyone from passing on. Karkul queued. He was almost grateful for the human interaction, the rough hands of the medical orderly who shoved Cargill's head down and puffed white counterseptic powder over his head and shoulders. "Open your top," the man said. "Lift your arms." Karkul obeyed and was pushed through the barricades. A woman was standing with a bucket in her hands. "Credits for food," she said, and handed him a food chit. Karkul wanted to say thank you, but the people behind him pushed him on. He tried to go back, but wardens waved their electrogoads at him. "Move along, no more credits for you." Karkul did as he was told. He tried at another intersection, but the counterseptic powder marked him out, and this time he got a crack on his back with a long cane. The chit said that it entitled Karkul to a meal. He was not sure what to do with it, and shopkeepers waved him on. "Not here," they said. Finally, Karkul saw another man handing over the credit chit for a jug of grog. The stall was named House of Mateo. It was a down-at-heel kind of place. There was an L-shaped counter in the corner, and a thin, weary-looking man with a short, dark beard and stained apron ready for orders. A plain board showed what was on the menu. There were two choices on offer, slab or slop. Karkul clutched his food chit and stepped forward. Another man sat behind the awning, with his chin on one fist, staring out into the street. There was an autogun under the counter. Karkul could see the butt, standard Munitorum issue, sprayed white with a serial number.
"I have this," Karkul said, holding up his credits.
"Slab or slop?" Mateo told him, without looking up. "How much is the brew?"
6 credits.
The serving for slop looked bigger, so Karkul took slop and a cup of brew. As the thin man started to fill a cardboard box, Karkul handed over the chit and 6 more credits, then quickly counted out how much he had left. At this rate, he'd be out by week's end.
"Where you from?" Karkul said.
"Here,"
the man said, as he took the money and handed the bowl over.
"I mean, before."
"Before? Who cares?"
"I'm an off-worlder too," Karkul said.
"You and every other frecker in this hellhole. Listen, I get paid to give out victuals. Conversation costs extra."
Karkul took his bowl and cup. He started inside. The man with the gun stepped in front of him.
"Eating inside is another credit."
Karkul saw the dark barrel of the gun aimed at him. He felt his cheeks colour and took a step back.
"Never mind," he stammered.
Karkul squatted in the filthy street. The slop was warm, at least, but the brew was sour. He shovelled it down and felt it coating his stomach. The man next to him wore a golden throne badge. He slurped his mash broth and scraped his bowl clean. He had a long face with buck teeth and scraggly grey hair.
"How long you been here?" the stranger said.
"Landed yesterday," Karkul said.
"Where did you come from?"
"Guardia Rex. I came via Ignatz and then Bray's Watch," Karkul said.
The man sniffed and looked at him. He'd not heard of them.
"Rich stars where you came from?"
Karkul nodded.
"Frickers," the other man said. "All of them. Look at that."
He turned and nodded up to the Evercity. It was small with distance, but the white masonry looked beautiful in the light of the setting sun.
"Won't let us in, not even to pray."
The man went on and on, but Karkul wasn't interested. He wanted to be up there, in the Evercity, where families with credits would request the rarefied services of a painter. The other man moved on to religion, which Karkul found even less interesting.
"And the rich stars are Templars," the man said, as if Karkul should know what this meant.
"What are Templars?"
Heretics, the man said.
Karkle had read the posters. Heretics were crazed monsters, rabid animals in human form. They hated life and order, and they hated art. The word chilled Karkle.
You mean like the Scourged?
No, but heretics all the same.
Karkle thought of the rich stars he had seen as a boy. None of them seemed to fit this description of a heretic. He scraped his ball clean and returned it to Matteo for the deposit. The man with the gun handed the credit back, begrudgingly. Karkle slipped it into his purse. He felt better now with a full belly. He stood and wondered which way to go as a procession of black-robed men marched up the road towards him. Before them went a band of penitents. One came towards Karkle. She was old and bent, but her eyes were kind, her grey stubble was patchy, and the skin of her scalp flaky and sore.
"The Emperor loves you," she said, and she embraced him.
It was such a brief and sudden moment of human kindness and warmth that he did not resist as she pressed him into her sagging chest. He closed his eyes for a moment, and it was like being with Agatha once more, the long-lost sense of being loved and cared for and safe.
"The Emperor loves you," she said. "Admit your sins and be chastised, and then you will be reborn."
She held his arms and looked at him, face to face.
"Have you sinned, my child?"
He didn't know if he was being accused, and stammered a brief answer.
I...
But did not know where to start.
"When you are ready, come and find us." "Here," she said, and pinned a yellow cloth to his chest,
which showed the palace of the Emperor on Holy Terror, with a rising sun behind it.
"A crusade has been announced. Join the Brotherhood and repent your sins."
Karkle remembered the sound of the first man he'd killed on the Cossack blade, the dull thud of steel bars shattering his skull, the splash as he fell face down into the water.
"I repent," he said,
but the words were formulaic, and she was already letting go and moving onwards, embracing the next in the crowd, telling him,
"The Emperor loves you."
It was an hour later that he stopped outside a slot bar and put his hand in his pocket, only to discover that his credits were gone. He checked everywhere, but they were empty, all of them. The only person he could think of was that woman, the penitent. He turned back, desperately retracing his footsteps, shoving his way desperately through the crowds that divided him from the procession.
"Have you seen the Brotherhood?"
he asked, and people pointed him north, south, east, and west. He heard one procession, the slap of whips on bare flesh, the clang of cowbells and the smell of censers burning, and grabbed a grey-haired, shaven-headed lady. But this one had a lazy eye, and the next was too tall, too thin. He was mad with fury. He had been tricked and betrayed. He grabbed another penitent, and a man shouted,
"Off,"
he said, and shoved Karkle away.
"You are the enemy of the holy. Repent."
Karkle was struggling to get up as fists and kicks rained down on him. He cradled his head in his arms, trying to keep the blows off, and at last the Brotherhood passed on. Karkle pushed himself up as the crowd closed behind the Crusaders, and he was alone once more. Chapter 11. As soon as Minka's squad got back to barracks, the ganger was carried off to the Medicare unit. Chief Commissar Shand came out of the regimental office. He saw the stretchers and paused, then walked towards her. She pretended she hadn't seen him and started speaking to Breve, but Shand's voice called out,
"Sergeant, come here."
She turned. Shand was a tall, thin man with a quiet and chilling manner. His augmetic eye gleamed red, and the rest of his face was taut with scar tissue.
"There was fighting?"
Minka stammered for a moment, trying to organise her thoughts.
Well, she started, we went to the Tent City. The place is run by gangs. I was discussing entry with their leader when...
How did the new intake perform?
Well, sir, we left 20 of them dead and captured the leader. I brought him back for questioning.
Did you lead your squad into unnecessary danger?
No, sir. A gun was discharged.
Commissar Shand loomed over her.
Whose gun?
Sergeant, the discipline of the regiment is my concern. Remember, it is your duty to deal with insubordination in your ranks. Any failings you cannot deal with should be brought to me. It is a capital offence for an officer to hide things from a commissar.
While her discipline was previously dealt with by officers, now she was an officer herself, her performance came under the direct jurisdiction of the commissariat.
Shan's gaze seemed to suck the information out of her. She had to cover for Arctua.
Well, Corporal Arctua's gun had a malfunction, she stammered. He thought we were in danger.
Corporal?
Shand called out. His voice was clear and compelling. Arctua was heading back to the barrack block.
I want to speak with you.
Everyone turned then. Arctua stopped. He seemed small as Shand's authority reeled him in like a hooked fish.
Corporal, you tell me. What happened on the patrol this afternoon?
Arctua's eyes met Minka's.
My gun misfired, he said. I was not used to a carbine.
But his demeanour was odd enough to raise Shan's suspicions. Stand straight, he commanded, and Arctua snapped to attention. Minka tried to give a warning, but there was something odd about Arctua's movements. They were slow and sloppy, and Shand had clearly noticed it.
I'm bringing you into custody, Corporal Arctua.
What for, sir?
Arctua blurted, but Shand did not reply as he led him away. Within minutes, black-clad commissars were striding towards the barrack rooms. The sudden flurry of commissariat activity was ominous. Jeremiah turned to Minka.
Did you report him?
No, I said nothing.
But Minka knew that she had screwed this up.
I said nothing. Listen, I've got to go to the Medicare unit, but afterwards I'll go speak to the bats on Arctua's behalf. The rest of you get a good rest. Drill tomorrow morning, 0500 hours. Understand?
They nodded. She let them walk away. She was exhausted and started for the barracks. Someone stepped up behind her.
So it went badly.
It was Prasan.
Yeah, she said. I'm sorry.
Her defences were back up again in an instant.
I've seen worse, she said.
During Minka's rehabilitation, she had spent more time than she liked with Medicare Banting. He'd made it clear many times how little he cared for military incompetence. There was no sympathy for Minka in this, just a dislike of the way that poor commanders cost him time and effort. He gave Minka a withering look as she stepped inside his room.
Sergeant Lesk, I have been hearing about your little adventure.
He had already cleaned out Silas's wound, covered it with pink counterseptic powder, and bandaged it.
How is it? Minka asked. It's too tight, Silas said, flexing his hand.
It'll stretch, Banting told him.
Silas took a low stick and lit it one-handed. Banting gave him a look.
Outside with that, he said.
Banting moved on. A medical aide was working to stabilise Thaddeus. The young man was lying in bed, shivering violently. Minka and her squad had done their best in the back of the Chimera, but now his jacket had been cut away to reveal skin red and charred. Where the blisters had been rubbed away, the raw red flesh showed through and clear fluids oozed down his back. Banting inspected the burn and called for an extra shot of soporific.
Don't think you can go now.
As you're responsible for these men, you can wash your hands and come and help.
He gave her the gauze to hold as he covered Thaddeus's wounds. She stood and watched as his burn was cleaned and then dressed with gauze. Thaddeus closed his eyes as the soporifics kicked in. His lips were moving. Minka didn't want to know what he was saying. It took nearly an hour to finish. Banting went to clean his hands. The nurse threw Thaddeus's ruined jacket into a sack labelled incineration. The soporifics were wearing off.
"Anything I can bring you?"
Thaddeus shook his head.
"Sure?"
He nodded. Minka was a little stuck for words. She noticed the ward ceiling was decorated with Baroque images of the Emperor.
"Well, this is a grand place to lie sick."
Thaddeus half laughed, half winced, as he gently lowered himself down on his side.
"Yes, Sarge. At least I'll have something to look at."
She helped him get comfortable, then said, "You'll be here for a while, I think. Sure there's nothing you need." He paused, taking this in.
"Well, something to read."
She slapped her pockets. She didn't have anything, except her primer. It was one of the few things that she had saved from Cadia.
"Lose this, and you will be shot," their trainers had told them when they were 10 years old. As White Shields, they'd taken the whole primer business seriously. It was a ritual joke played on all new conscripts. Now she weighed it in her hand and handed it over to him.
"Lose this and you'll be shot," she said. He half laughed again.
"It'll keep you going until I get something. Until then, you can buff up on principles and regulations."
"Thanks," Thaddeus said.
As she left, Banting called her over.
"So, I hear you brought a ganger back and I have to go and patch him up."
"Sorry."
"Don't apologise. Putting holes into people is what you're trained to do."
"I do me best."
"Indeed. Well, doesn't seem like today was a very good start. Are you sure you're up to this?"
"Yes," she said.
"Really?"
"Yes."
Banting's manner was clear. She had frecked up.
"From what I heard, you were lucky. It could have been much worse."
"It could always be worse," Minka said. When she came out of the Medicaid ward, Commissar Cadet Knoll was waiting for her. He waved a form at her.
"Sergeant, Commissar Shand has found a large quantity of Obscura in Corporal Arctua's possession. Were you aware of this?"
"No," she answered quickly.
"You are sure?"
"Yes," she said. "I mean, I suspected Grinweed."
Knoll marked the form and she scribbled her signature on it.
"If you or anyone else is complicit,"
Knoll warned, leaving the second half of the sentence unspoken. She could tell from his manner that he was excited about the find. Excited because Arctua would be shot. No doubt Knoll wanted to shoot someone himself.
"I understand," Minka said.
By the time she got to the mess, dinner had already been served. Minka grabbed one of the plates that had been left for stragglers. They were filled with scrapings and leftover slab. When she was done, she went to her quarters and looked for Dido, but her bunk was empty, and instead there was only a pair of troopers bent over a map of potence. The afternoon shadows were lengthening. Minka wanted a bit of quiet. She went out into the barrack yard. There were worn steps leading up to the firing parapet. It was almost cold enough for a jacket. There were fine views out over the southern expanse of the Evercity. She paused and took in a deep breath. The golden light reminded her of better times. Her mind lingered as she stood, elbows on the battlement, looking down from the high barrack quarters. The sun set quickly here. She stayed until the bright colours were funnelling from the sky, then let her fingers brush along the parapet as she strolled towards the east side. A figure stood there, hands braced on the lip of the rockcrete buttress. It was Shand. He appeared suddenly, as if he had been seeking her out. "Sergeant," he said, and she knew she could not avoid him. She saluted and walked forward. The sound of gunfire rose from the Evercity. She felt she had to say something. "It doesn't seem very peaceful down there."
"Nowhere is peaceful," he said.
There was something painful about the expression on his lean face. It was cold and hard and distant. His scarred knuckles were white. The tension within him alarmed her. Then, quite suddenly, he turned and looked down on her.
"You know we found Obscura in Arctua's belongings?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you know the penalty?"
"Yes, sir."
She didn't need to ask. Arctua would be shot. "No, I mean the penalty for not reporting relevant material to a commissar."
"Yes, sir. I didn't know anything about it, I swear."
"No?"
Her cheeks coloured purple.
"No, sir. I mean, I knew he was lax. They all seem lax, this new lot. I thought a bit of discipline would sort him out. If I had any suspicions of Obscura, I would have brought it to your attention immediately."
Shand paused. "You were on Marquis," he said. It was not a question. It was a statement.
"Yes, sir."
"I have been going through your reports, Lesk. On Marquis, you were a trooper in D Company."
She became stiff.
"Yes, sir. We went in with the first wave, in Hellbores."
"D Company suffered..." He paused and picked a guard euphemism. "Heavy casualties."
"Yes, sir. Only two of us made it out. Myself and Groger."
"Only two out of 137 troopers."
Minka spoke carefully.
"That is right, sir."
Shand drew in a deep breath, as if quelling the pain, then said,
"That is lucky, don't you think?"
She spoke defensively.
"What, sir?"
"You tell me."
He turned his baleful red eye on her. He'd been fighting and shooting troopers so long that his whole body exuded menace. She couldn't look him in the face.
"In your report, you mentioned finding a chapel in the ruins of the city."
"Did I?"
"Yes," he said. His tone was definite. "You did. Describe it."
Minka felt sweat on her brow.
"It's not very clear, to be honest, sir. The medicae said I had toxic shock."
"Describe it to me."
Minka stiffened. She described it as far as she could remember. At the end, she looked up at him. He had turned away and was staring out into the darkening sky. A flight of three fighters was making a sweep across the city. They looked like thunderbolts from here, and in the distance, a lander was making its ungainly descent to the starport. It looked too big and fat and slow to fly. He nodded to himself.
"And you say you saw a heretic?"
"There were many heretics."
"You know what I mean."
She swallowed.
"Yes," she said at last. She knew what he meant.
She coughed to clear her throat.
"Do you know what they call themselves?"
She shook her head. She didn't want to know.
"They call themselves the Eaters of Worlds."
Minka said nothing.
"They are the enemy that we have to face, to break, to eradicate from the galaxy. The Holy Emperor gives us the strength we need to purge the unclean."
She felt sick.
"Yes, sir."
He turned to her again. "Are you strong enough to break them?"
"I..."
she stammered. For a moment, she was back in the underhive while the heretic space marines came at her. 8 feet of rage, half a ton of hatred. Each of the band of guardsmen she was with had thrown themselves at it, and each had been cut down.
"Nothing stopped it."
"How did you survive, then?"
"I cannot say. I don't remember."
"Don't or won't?"
She rallied now. "Confessor Kerem examined me at length. It was not pleasant.
but I have been passed fit for duty, not only physically, but also spiritually."
She looked from his human eye to his augmetic one, and back again. He did not look like he believed her.
"We do not flee from the enemy, Sergeant Lesk. That makes them stronger. We die defying them and their creed. That is our duty as guardsmen and women. With our deaths, we make ourselves martyrs. In death, we conquer. That is the motto of the 101st. Do you know what that means?"
She nodded, but she could not look him in the face any longer. Her voice was thin.
"Yes, sir. I know that, sir. I live by that standard."
She stood next to him for a moment, looking out over the city as the lumens came on and lit the major arteries. The mess bell rang. It was 10 minutes until lights out. At that moment, there was the distinctive sound of a shot ringing out across the barrack square.
"Ah," Shand said, "I think Arctur has gone to make his peace with the Emperor.
Be careful, Sergeant Lesk, that you do not follow him." Chapter 12. That first night on Portens, Karkle found a pile of rubbish in a quiet area of the tent city to sleep on. He looked out towards the distant lights of the Evercity. "I must get out of this hell," he told himself. He tried to rest, but night in the tent city was haunted by angry shouts and screams, and then the deathly silence that came after gunfire. He got up before the sun rose, mouth filled with saliva and his stomach echoing and empty. He could smell freshly baking bread. It took him half an hour, following his nose, to find the place. Only the desperate and the homeless were up at this time. The bakery truck stood alone within an empty pair of blocks, where no tents had been raised and the ground was strewn with weeds and shrubs. The rear carriage of the truck had been converted to bread ovens. Under the discoloured linen awning, figures worked, sliding trays of bread out of proving chambers into ovens, and then out into a short marquee of red, white and blue striped plastic cloth, where people were eating. The scent was so strong, he could almost chew upon it. He was about to walk across the open space when he heard the sound of knives being sharpened. He moved closer. Through the open flap of an awning, he saw labourers mixing sacks of ground beans and flour, kneading and cutting dough, a few men standing over large vats. There were enormous heaps of dough waiting to be cut and shaped. And there, on shelves, were long white loaves, dusted with flour. Karkle moved closer. Another vehicle had pulled up, and he hunkered down as labourers filled it with baskets of freshly baked crusty bread, piled up on the open back. Karkle could barely believe his luck. He waited until the labourers had gone. The drivers were exchanging stories. Karkle hurried into the shadow of the truck. He could hear a voice talking on the other side of the vehicle, and looking under the chassis, he saw two booted feet standing, turning, and then walking away. He heard the name Zarpal and orders. Zarpal seemed important from the way they spoke his name, but the smell of bread was overwhelming. Desperation gave him confidence. Just one loaf. Two, maybe. The metal was slippery and hard to get a handle on. He pushed and pulled and got his head over the side, looking down onto crates of loaves. He grabbed one. And another. And another. The bread was still warm. He tore off a bite. The breaking crust let out aromas he had almost forgotten about in his long months on board the ship. In a rush of memories, it brought back his life as a mixer of paints. In terror and elation, he shoved the three loaves down his front, grabbed a fourth, and then dropped to the ground and started to run back the way he had come. But in his haste, he tripped and fell flat on his face, one hand still holding the loaf up to save it from the dirt. He cursed, and looked back to see what had caught his foot. The ugly face of a thick, bald, heavy-set man with steel teeth and a nose that had been broken more times than a china pot looked down on him. He had a leopard tattoo leaping up his neck. Karkul started to apologise, but the man moved forward and stepped on his hand. Karkul cried out. When the man spoke, his voice was a deep rumble, like a landslide.
"You thieving little turd! I'll tear your eyes out if I find you in my territory again," the man said. "Do you understand?"
Karkul took the opportunity to speak.
"Sorry, sir. I only arrived yesterday. I'm a painter."
Karkul spoke quickly.
"I painted the rich stars. I can serve you."
"Rich stars?" the man growled. "Don't speak to me of rich stars."
He reached down and took Karkul's face in one hand. The strength in that grip had to be enhanced. The man dragged Karkul to his feet and lifted him from the floor.
"What is your name?" the steel-toothed man said.
"Karkul," he said.
"Well, Karkul, we're sick of your kind skulking about, stealing, thieving, robbing. Do you understand?"
"Master Zarpal sent me,"
Karkul said confidently. The name seemed to work like a charm. The man put him down and dusted his front down.
"Oh, I am sorry. Master Zarpal, you should have said."
"Yes, no matter. I understand what it is like, everyone starving."
"Exactly," the man said, nodding towards the starport. "All they do is bring more thieves every day. And who is policing them? No one. They leave it to us. We have to look after ourselves in this world."
"I know," Karkul said, desperate to get away. "Zarpal sends his compliments."
"Does he now?" the bruiser said.
"To me?" "What's your name?"
"Hammer," the brute said.
"Yes, you."
Hammer smiled, steel teeth glimmering with reflected lumens.
"That's mighty kind of him."
Karkul brushed off the dirt from his clothes and turned to go. He could not believe his luck.
"Wait," Hammer said,
and Karkul turned. He had a brief glimpse of the man's ugly face before the headbutt hit him square in the face. Then all was pain. Hammer bent down to him and picked him up as if he were a rag doll.
"Now, Karkul, tell me how it was that Zarpal spoke to you when only yesterday I cut him open from neck to navel. Has he come back from the dead?"
Chapter 13. The ganger that Minka had brought back from the tent city refused to speak until it was made clear that he had little choice. The information he gave was added to files compiled by the Cadian intelligence officers. All these were taken up to Colonel Beitov. Colour Sergeant Dahl had then been summoned by Major Kastelek.
"It's a damned mess," the Major said, tossing the file down on the table.
"Yes," Dahl said. "Sorry, sir. It was my fault. I thought it would be straightforward. I didn't realise that the enforcers had given up on the place. From what I heard, Lesk did well, I think, not to lose her entire squad. She's young but tough."
Major Kastelek did not seem convinced.
"Beitov is not going to be impressed."
Dahl knew that. Kastelek went on.
"So, what next?" "We go in hard. Street gangs understand one thing. We'll have to drum it into their heads that we're here and we're not going to let gangs tear that place apart."
"Right. Let 4th Platoon take this. Give them everything they need. I suggest they take tanks and blow, what do they call themselves?
The cartel halfway to hell. Then I'll make a full report to Beitov."
Dahl smiled.
"Yes, sir."
An hour later, three squadrons of Lemon Rust tanks accompanied 4th Platoon in a convoy of 5 Chimeras. There was no debate this time,
as they approached the cartel territory. As soon as the gangers saw the armour, they tried to pull back, but as they leapt into their improvised gun rigs, the lead Lemon Russ fired. The range was over 800 yards, a long shot, with the tank moving at full speed. The high explosive shell hit the nearest truck squarely. The impact tore the vehicle apart, throwing bodies into the air like dolls, and a salvo followed, pounding the enemy checkpoint. The shrapnel ripped through flesh and steel, but the shockwaves killed many more, and the survivors fled in panic, leaving the burning wrecks of their transports. The wrecks were still burning as the Cadian convoy rammed them to the side. They pounded any gangers they could find and burned their bases, and when they were fired upon, they responded with extreme force. After 3 hours, they returned to base, leaving a square mile of Tent City burning. Tyson had led his platoon. He was in a foul mood as he strode into the colonel's office. Sparker was sitting with his feet up, smoking a low stub, a sheaf of parchment reports open on his lap, half read. He put his feet down and sat up as Tyson entered.
"Right," he said. "Tell me."
Tyson pulled a chair up opposite and sat down. Colonel Sparker handed a low stub across the desk. Tyson put it between his teeth as he leant forward to light it. Tyson took a puff, then exhaled a thin cone of blue smoke.
"Well, we cleared the cartel out, but gangers are running the whole place. Hive gangers, mostly. They're fighting over territory."
"Any sign of the enforcers?"
"None. They've given up entirely. Gangers have taken over everything. They're selling food donations, and they've clearly got their hands on an arms shipment. The cartel had heavy weaponry, Goliaths, a couple of half-tracks."
"Are they loyal?"
"Throne knows. But no signs of heresy."
Sparker nodded.
"But the desperate turn to desperate means. Think we can bring them over to our side?"
"Are we that desperate?"
Sparker nodded.
"Apparently, yes. Orbital City fell 10 days ago. Looks like the Navy frecked up again."
"Any sign of the Calibaneer?"
"Not a whiff. Or at least not yet," Sparker said.
"They're running scared, I think. Or digging in. At this rate, the Scourged could be here within weeks, days even. We might need the gangs fighting on our side."
Tyson said nothing.
Sparker sighed. "And there's this."
He pushed a card file towards Tyson. It was marked with a commissariat stamp. The red letters read, "Executed.
Corporal Arctur, Lesk's squad. He's been shot."
Tyson puffed out his cheek. He took the file and opened it. He'd not seen an executed stamp for a long time.
"The commissars found enough obscura to get half the regiment dazed."
"Freck," Tyson said.
Sparker nodded. "And in my company. I've had Commissar Shand in here for 2 hours. He's taken this all very personally. If anyone steps out of line..."
Tyson nodded.
"Can we have the executions registered to the Red Skulls?"
Sparker pursed his lips.
"I'll try. Officially, they're ours, of course, but..."
"But the 101st have not had a man shot for 3 years. I'll be damned if this new lot are going to bring us all down."
Sparker said nothing. He looked as if he felt the same, but he couldn't say so.
"I'll talk to Shand. We'll need to get Lesk another corporal."
"Victor?"
"No. Make it one of the new lot, for company cohesion and all."
"I'll look into it."
Colonel Sparker nodded and took a long drag of his low stub. He picked up one of the reports in his lap.
"System command is clearly running scared. Apparently, potents can't fall. This place has huge symbolic significance for the whole sector. Something to do with the local saint. He's the founder of the local dynasty. They've sent us an imperial general to take command of the defence."
"Great. Another rich star."
Sparker smiled.
"No, actually. He's Cadian, apparently."
Tyson laughed. "Then there is hope after all."
Sparker quoted an old saying that was taught to Cadians in their third year of Skolam. "Don't trust in hope," he started. Tyson put up his hand. "I know. Hope is the first step on the road to disappointment." Chapter 14. Across Potence, the Calabaneer were finally taking up defensive positions, while a general mobilisation of reservists was set in motion. At the same time, a general evacuation of the outlying steadings, ore quarries and intakes had been ordered, to happen within the week, leaving only skeleton crews to keep the operations running. Meanwhile, the defence of the Evercity began in earnest. Reservists used dozer blades fitted to the front of cargo 8s to build tank emplacements and earthen redoubts against possible attack. The walls of the Evercity were fortified with razor wire and sandbags, while the approaches to the main gates were surrounded by fields of rusting steel tank traps. The Cadians spent the next morning digging trenches around the Acropolis. The Ecclesiarchy authorities had insisted that they did not enter the cathedral itself, but they fashioned defensive positions on the main approaches to the Acropolis, heavy weapon platforms overlooking the steep roads, and tanks and artillery used their dozer blades to pile up earth to offer them protection from below. Where the rocky terrain did not allow for tank scrapes, the Cadians laboured in work gangs, rolling water barrels into place or laying sandbags along low walls. The news of Arctua's execution cast a shadow over them all. A few blamed Arctua, some blamed the bats, most blamed Minka. Disapproval hung about her like a bad smell. Even Sergeant Dahl bumped into her as she was filling sandbags. Dahl took the back of her head in his hand and pulled her face close to his. "Lesk, why didn't you tell me? If anyone frecks up, then you come and see me, understand? We sort it out within the regiment, understand?" She felt stupid. It felt like the 100th time she had given the same excuse. "Yes, sir, but I didn't know." He squeezed her neck and shook her. "First execution in 3 years, for freck's sake. I reported what happened at the Tent City, that was all. A few days penal. If he hadn't got obscura on him..." Dahl was not interested. "Hush! Do you know what happens when one commissar gets a scalp? Do you know what all the others start thinking? I'll tell you what. They start thinking, where's mine? Have you seen the look in Noel's eyes? He's itching to shoot someone. They start to get competitive. How many freckers have you shot this week? That's what they start thinking. The bats tell themselves that they've been too soft on us and they want to make sure they're doing their job." Minka was sick of having the finger of blame pointed at her. "You mean the next person who gets shot is my fault?" Dahl's temper was up. "Yes," he snapped. "That's exactly what I'm saying." When they got back to barracks, an information bulletin had been posted. It confirmed what everyone knew. Contact with Orbital City had been lost. On top of that, the Scourged were now within a short warp jump from Potence, a planet-wide evacuation of smaller habitations was taking place, and the Navy picket was being pulled back to the waystation of Namara. Captain Fearwood happened to be standing there. He had been a sergeant a week ago and was now struggling with the command of 2nd Platoon. The others turned to him. "When do you think the Scourged will be here?" "When? I think it's really still if. But seeing how quickly they've made it from Bray's watch, I'd say they could be here within the week." The atmosphere changed noticeably at that. Some stared up at the notice board, others moved off in silence. Minka made herself scarce. Dido found her sitting cross-legged on her bunk, her carbine disassembled on the blanket before her. "Hey," Dido said. Minka did not look up. "Hey," Dido repeated, louder this time. Minka dropped the weight of the pull-through down the barrel and pulled the cotton bung up. "I screwed up," she said. Dido tilted her head in a non-committal gesture.
Well, yeah, but it wasn't your fault.
He let off his gun. He almost got us all killed. I didn't know he was dealing Obscura. But thank Thro and the bats found it. He deserved to be shot. Now everyone has given me that look.
What look?
The you've let me down look.
Dido forced a smile.
Have you spoken to the squad?
No. Minka paused, the barrel and butt of her carbine in her hands. Her body language said it all. Dido pulled an encouraging face.
They'll understand. They know what happened.
She didn't sound confident. There was a faint click as Minka twisted the barrel of her carbine back into place. She lifted it to her eye and checked it.
I wish I was just a trooper still, taking orders, doing my job.
Shand is on my case. He started asking about Marquis, how Grogar and I survived.
How did you survive?
I don't know, Minka answered. For a moment, there were tears in her eyes.
I have dreams, but all I know is that they dragged us out of the slime. The rest is a mess.
Dido didn't speak for a long moment, but at last she said,
Well, the Emperor's called you.
Do you think he has?
Of course, otherwise you wouldn't have made it.
Do you think it works like that?
What do you mean?
I mean, do you think the Emperor cares about what one of us does? We're just troopers. There are millions of us, billions. Do you really think he cares what we do or how we fight or how we die?
Of course he cares, Dido said. We're Cadians.
Yes, but really, do you think he cares about you, Dido Frevran? Is he watching you?
Dido pulled a face. I don't know, she paused. I've never thought about it like that.
You haven't? Dido shook her head. There was a long silence as Minka kept fitting the bits together.
I think about it all the time, she said at last. And do you have an answer?
Minka shook her head. No, she said. I mean, I hope he watches us. I tell myself he's watching us. When I'm terrified, I remember his sacrifices, his pain, and his great gift to us all. And I imagine he is standing behind me, and sometimes that makes me strong.
She was about to go on, but stopped. This felt taboo, the kind of thing one should not say aloud.
Minka drew in a deep breath.
But sometimes I have black thoughts where I don't think he's watching us. I don't think he cares. Then all this seems pointless.
Dido lowered her voice. That's how heretics talk. Minka stopped. Dido was right. She should not allow herself to even think such a thing. She took in a deep breath and nodded.
I know. I'm sorry. I'll say my prayers.
Good. Don't speak like that, Minka. There was a long pause. Dido forced a smile, and she spoke breezily now, as if she were about to leave.
Heard about Orbital City?
Minka nodded. No time for thinking when battle was near. Dido kept up her banter.
You should get your squad bonding. You know, as we used to do as White Shields, everyone out, full pack, 6 miles, 38 minutes. Everyone succeeds, or they do it all again.
It was almost silly to be going back to White Shield training, but Dido seemed sure.
I'm doing it. Binds everyone together.
It sounds too simple.
Command is simple. You lead from the front and answer every question with a definitive answer. It doesn't matter whether you're right or wrong. Let the regimental historians bother about that. Just make a decision. And remember, the new lot are Cadians too. Whatever is frecked with them had to be bad.
Worse than Markgraf?
Had to be.
Somehow I don't believe it. Minka let out a breath. But I'll give it a go.
Good, Dido said. And that other crap about the Emperor. Go see Kerim if you must. But don't talk like that again.
Minka threw on her jacket and strode through the barrack halls to personally issue the orders. She found her troopers in small groups, playing cards or lying on their bunks. Full kit run tomorrow, 0500 hours.
Some grunted, some groaned, and some appeared not to hear her at all. She had no time for this.
"Hear me?"
"Yes," they said. As she turned to go, a figure stepped out in front of her. She tried to go past him, but he stepped in front of her again. She was about to shove past when he spoke.
"My name is Laptev. I'm your new corporal."
She sized him up. From his scars, it was clear that he'd taken a couple of hard rounds in the Emperor's name. But now his hands were thrust deep into his pockets and his jacket was unbuttoned, his belt loosely buckled about his waist. He was the kind of fighter whose smile looked threatening, the kind of thug you didn't want to cross.
"Laptev, good. Welcome."
She put out a hand, but he did not shake it. Minka kept her hand out. He made no movement.
"I'm your corporal, not your buddy," he said.
"Right," she said, and took her hand back. "Full kit run, tomorrow, 0500 hours. It took a long time for Minka to calm down enough to sleep. She did not say her prayers, but did press-ups till sweat ran down her face and her shoulders burned and she couldn't lift her face from the floor. The workout helped. She lay on her bed and stared up at the ceiling and calmed her breathing. At some point, she must have fallen asleep, a restless sleep, punctuated by dreams. In one dream, she was 13 again. A campfire was burning against the night. She was on the Kajikades Islands, and a sea breeze was whipping at the low flames. Her face and boots were warm, the rest of her was cold, and about her came the sound of wind whistling through the low heather on the moortop. In another, she was a child again, in the hab zone of Kazamairak, walking with her brother to the bread shop, getting a pound of the dense black tuckwheat loaf.
"Want a cutting?" the baker said.
He was a veteran, had one arm, but managed to get the loaf into the slicing machine and fed it through into the brown paper bag.
"Here."
She gave him the ration tab and he dropped it into his bucket, walking back with her brother. Her brother. In dreams, he felt so real, so alive. She could turn and talk to him and he would respond and speak like a living person.
"I'll carry it," her dream self said, and he handed her the bag and she could feel the rough paper in her hand.
What was his name, she thought, and tried to turn to him to ask, but she could not. She was 8 or 9 and she was walking home with her brother, carrying the bread ration for that day. It was a good place to pause and remember, but her dream mind lingered too long and the wolves of memory caught her. As she turned to her brother, she was no longer in the dark street of Kazamairak, but underground, and the ceiling was drip lime stalactites. She was knee-deep in slime pools. She knew she had stayed too long in the past and tried to wake, but the wolves had her tight and would not let go. She could hear him, like the roar of a giant, the flash of red, and